I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. Great joy today to welcome Roy Gobel as our guest on Conversing. Roy is based in the Bay Area. He's the CEO of Gobel Properties and the director of Pathlight International, an effort and program that's going on in Belize, which we'll talk a little bit more about. And then the author of two books. His first book was a book called Junkyard Wisdom, and his most recent book is entitled Salvaged. We'll explain much more about that as time goes on. Roy, welcome. We're glad to have you.
Hey, thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
You know, I've received lots of books over the course of my time doing this podcast and before, where people send me books to read. And I got a copy of your book, which I was excited to receive because we had been talking about it and I knew it was coming. And then when the book actually arrived, it came in a cardboard box with some things that I just think I want to ask the listeners to this to imagine. So in this small little cardboard box came the book itself, Salvaged. But then also in it was a little, I would call it, antique toy truck and two wildflower seed balls. I thought for a moment that they were chocolates and just resisted barely in time to realize that actually it was about the planting of wildflower seeds and not chocolate candies I was reading. Some sprockets of different sizes and ages, a pinball, and I meant not the machine, but the ball of a pinball machine, and grease monkey wipes, heavy-duty cleaning wipes. Now, right. I do think you're a man of great metaphor, or you wouldn't have written books called, you know, Junkyard Wisdom and Salvaged. So in a way, this felt really very much in keeping. But like, tell me about this. What is the idea behind that and the and the blue paper wipes?
Yeah, I'm glad you got it. And we had a lot of fun with that. The publicist and I and my assistant put those together with the idea that we wanted people to take notice when the book came out. The book is all based on my experiences growing up in my dad's junkyard. And one of the metaphors that I'm playing with is how greasy and grimy and messy the wrecking yard was where I grew up, but how true that is for the world we live in. Right. And for instance, the gears that are in there, I had a lot of fun finding those. Those were hard to find, actually, because they're small enough that they weren't super expensive to ship, but big enough that they felt like, you know, sprockets and gears and exactly. Something that was really functional. And to make those work, you've got to have a little grease in them.
Yeah.
And I think life's that way too. You got to have a little grease in it. And sometimes we want to so over sanitize our lives
yes.
that we don't get anywhere. We right. can't move forward because those sprockets are all locked up. So right. we had fun with the metaphors that were in there. The flower bombs were, hey, even flowers can grow in the midst of the grease and the grime
right.
of the world.
Absolutely. Well, it was a great and memorable way for a book to arrive. I love this image that you're using of they need some grease. So let's start by talking about grease. In a certain way, one of the things that's interesting about both of your books, playing off of the metaphors of your dad's junkyard business, is really that you're trying to clearly fill a gap. And I'm wondering how you would describe the gap that you think your books are trying to step into, addressing something that you think is either underappreciated, unseen, not integrated. How would you describe the space that you're trying to speak into?
Oh, that's a great question. I love the idea that there's a gap there because honestly, Mark, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a great question. I think part of the gap that I hope I'm filling is this idea that we have these clean, simple solutions for mm-hmm. life, and we don't. Mm-hmm. And so many books and messages that we hear have these sort of five-step solutions to things yes. or 12-step mm-hmm. or whatever. Some of that's good. I'm not in any way criticizing that. But we live in a much more complex world than I think a few simple steps can really resolve. And I love the idea of embracing that tension. So I write towards that. I want to fill that gap where, hey, it's okay to not have all the answers all the time,
right,
and to just embrace that tension.
Right, right. You know, one of the phrases that comes to mind when I've read your books has been a phrase that has been used by others called holy worldliness. And I want to pay you what I consider to be a compliment, which is that I think you're an example of a person striving to live as a holy worldly person, H-O-L-Y. And and I think it's trying to say, how do you live into a real world space? In your case, certainly your dad's junkyard world, but also the real estate world, the educational world, the missional world that you've been a part of, the corporate universe you've been a part of, the educational institutions you've been part of, the sense that you're actually a citizen, you're a resident, you're present, you're engaged in the things that are going on around you, but you're trying to do that in a way that is marked by a full understanding of the holiness of God, which isn't about separation, but about a distinctiveness of life and character. That's the space that, from my point of view, is where your books both land. Does that resonate with your sense of things from what you just said?
It does. Thank you for the compliment. And as you were talking and asking that question, I was thinking about how proactive Dion and I were, my wife Dion and I, in raising our kids to engage the world.
Right.
And a lot of people want to raise their kids to protect them from the world. And of course, as parents, we have that responsibility. But we really wanted them to engage the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've tried as well in our personal lives to engage the world.
Mm-hmm.
My first book, which you mentioned, Junkyard Wisdom, is about breaking down those walls between us as successful, wealthy people that have great opportunities and great connections. But we also want to engage the world where the world is hurting, where the world is broken, and be real in that context, not to just be this sort of temporary presence that mm-hmm. comes and goes,
mm-hmm.
but to be truly engaged and real. And I think, honestly, some of this is what led my daughter to Fuller.
Right.
She's a graduate. And I think it's because she so appreciated the authenticity and the engagement that Fuller allowed her to have.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that that is true. I think this is a space that is something that really matters to Fuller. And I do think that it's made evident in our curriculum and teachers, and it's certainly in the climate of a lot of student engagement. It is a space that draws people to Fuller, I think. But I'm interested, you know, Roy, as you were growing up, I don't know your background with all the detail to be able to fill out these questions from my point of view, but, you know, I have a sense of your life growing up as a kid in the context of your dad's junkyard. And I think your first book, Junkyard Wisdom, really captured that in a wonderful way. And the second book, Salvaged, picks up on those same metaphors and moves it further ahead. What I don't feel like I know yet enough about yet, and I'd love to have you talk about, is who or what have been the main factors that have helped bring this kind of double-themed life, holy worldliness, if we want to use that phrase, together for you? Were there primary exemplars to you? Was it your dad? Was it someone else? Who along the way were the people that were exemplars that helped to even inspire this kind of way of thinking about the world?
Certainly my father was, and I dedicated my second book to him because he taught me so much about leadership and really engaging in the world. He was certainly a man of his era and of his age. He was a World War II veteran. He made basically a fortune in junkyards and transitioned that into real estate development until he passed about 12 years ago or so. My mom was a big part of that as well. The depth of her spiritual life is still astonishing to me. And I just saw her yesterday, for instance, and in just this brief moment, here's this nearly 95-year-old woman that's suffering from dementia. I still grew spiritually from just talking to her about her life and her perspective. I'd also say that the pastor that we had in the church that I attended growing up, again, he was a man of his times, but he was a man that embraced truth vehemently. And he allowed for authenticity, allowed for failure. He allowed for people to be who they are. And he was a great encouragement that way. My own experience in college, I went to Westmont, and an opportunity to go to a school where you could really think, and you were encouraged to think, not just learn a doctrine. I think all of those things were factors growing up that allowed me to become the person I am.
So would you say that those are the things that are the grease, or would you add other ingredients to the grease?
I certainly think that I have to say all of those things were sort of the nutrients in the soil. But without a doubt, it was multiple different Holy Spirit moments where I was given opportunities, or I met people, or was opportunities to gain an insight. All of those things were big factors. And I think this being able to hold two seemingly opposites together is, that certainly is wisdom, but it is also spiritual growth. Mm-hmm. Because we're fallen people, and yet we're reconciled with Christ. That just makes no sense. Mm-hmm. So we hold these things separate, and yet we are somehow holding them together. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of gets to the core of part of what you're asking me.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about both books is that you are working in this terrain that you call wisdom, which I think is right. I think it is the wisdom tradition, the biblical wisdom tradition, and also an understanding that that wisdom, the definition I've often used for wisdom is that wisdom is the truth and character of God lived in context. And by the time you stack all those things together, which is what I think happens in an ordinary real space, like let's say the junkyard or ordinary relationships or the organizations that we're in or the cultural patterns that we're a part of, they all present this ordinary real context. And the question is, what more do we bring to it? And and I think what you're trying to say is that, but I think you're also trying to say, how do we learn from what's there everything that we possibly can, which is where, you know, the way that you develop the metaphors of your writing has been part of trying to suck the marrow out of the bone, if you want to put it that way, to try to get to the best part and to try to describe what comes out if you really pay close attention.
Very well said. I'm just going to go with your answer because I think that was much better said than mine.
No, what I'm getting at is more, you have an instinct for wisdom. I don't think everybody actually does. And I think the kind of thing that you're describing doesn't just happen. I wish that people hungered for real wisdom, which is, I think, this life intention, more the way you're describing it, more than it is a simple solution. So what about the tension part? I mean, I think a lot of people want to know what they would call something that's true, but wisdom doesn't really just look like truth. It looks like truth in context, right?
And
how do you live, what's honed your capacity to be able to live in that tension positively?
Well, you know, it's just a sort of the one word that really pops out is grace. And I think the reason that word comes to mind immediately is that the tension that I have lived in has led to all kinds of failures. And it could be business failures, it could be ministry failures, relationship failures. And those failures were always met with grace. Certainly heavenly grace, the grace we receive from God, but also the grace of the people around me. My church, my home, my family, the people that I work with. I've been so blessed with this amazing grace to constantly fail and hold these tensions that exist, to be running a for-profit business that wants to make a real difference in the world for the weak and the oppressed and the poor, and running a ministry that needs to be run in a business perspective. And to kind of live into those things.
Right.
I fail constantly at it, but there's always this grace that just whets my appetite to go back and embrace the opposites again.
Yeah. Yeah. So you suggest two directions. One is, you know, from the goodness to the hard challenges and the vulnerabilities, and then from the vulnerabilities to the hard challenges of good business practice and sensible leadership and all those kind of things. So let's talk for just a minute about both of those two directions. So when you think about the challenge of going from your business success to respond to a world of vulnerable need, what are the main challenges you think of holding onto the for-profit instinct and moving it toward a cause that's greater than its own bottom line?
Right. For us as a company, it was actually having a deeper and more meaningful understanding of how our work impacted the world around us. So I can remember, this would have been in the early 80s, my dad and I purchased a building in a very old part of San Jose, California. And this was when Silicon Valley was just becoming Silicon Valley. We bought this massive, like 100,000 square foot warehouse that had been built 50 years prior. And we proceeded to remodel it and make it useful again for, instead of one big tenant of 100,000 square feet, 20 tenants of 5,000 mm-hmm. square feet. I can remember the city inspector coming to me, and we sat down, we talked through some issues that we had, and he said, you know, you're not just making a real estate development project here, you're doing community renewal. Mm. And it struck me in that moment of how he understood my business in some ways better than I did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I began to talk about that more and more in terms of the work that we did as a mm-hmm. real estate company. And much to my surprise, it really motivated people.
Wow.
Whether it was the architects that we were using or the engineers or the laborers or the contractors or the city, suddenly there was this purpose behind it.
Right.
It was so much more than just, hey, let's turn a profit.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting example of how just slightly turning even the language and the framing and the motivation so that you can actually see it clearly and let it do its full work.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very... I think that when I have talked to other people that I know that are in business and they are in senior roles of leadership and they talk about the challenges of the drive for profit, there's often such a sense of, especially if you're in a public corporation, of public accountability. In your case, you're leading a private company, which gives you a freedom, I'm assuming, to do things in your own way that would be harder if you were leading in a public company setting, for sure. Yeah. Is that not?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And what would be examples to help people just ground this? What would be examples in the last month of ways that you've tried to think through how to keep the legitimate drive for profit in its orientation toward a purpose that's greater than profit?
Something that just recently happened was we have a building that's vacant and has been vacant quite a long time. We had a prospective tenant approach us about leasing us, and I went through their business model and what they were doing, and really, frankly, I just disagreed with what they were doing. I'm not going to mention who they are or what they did, but I just ethically disagreed with their work. And it pained me, but I said, no, we're not going to take the deal. Literally 2 days later, we received notice that somebody else had made an offer that was much more legitimate and actually more financially stable and was willing to pay more. Hmm. So you can say we got lucky on that one. You can say it was God's grace on that one. But I think we make these decisions sometimes that are pushing us towards compromise constantly. And we need to find ways to hold firm. That is, as you say, especially difficult in a public corporate mm-hmm. setting because you have shareholders you have to make happy and mm-hmm. all of the rest. Mm-hmm. But we still have to find ways, I think, to avoid being Pilate and just washing our hands of mm-hmm. what was really a very bad decision.
Right, right, yeah. Has it affected how readily you do or don't partner with other property companies?
Oh my gosh, yes. Oh yes, definitely. We have the good fortune of having been in the Bay Area now, well, really since before I was born. My dad started the company. And so we know a lot of the players and we know a lot of people and we know who not to work with. Mm-hmm. So combination of their ethics or maybe just their business model mm-hmm. you know, is designed to maximize their profits at the expense of everybody around them. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things make me very nervous. Mm-hmm. I believe that we need to live in a win-win world, not a game where my win is your loss.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm currently living in a setting where we live in a condominium on a fourth floor of a building that allows us to overlook a property on which they're building a four-story underground garage and a five-story building above mm-hmm. ground. And the company that's doing the construction is one that I am studying every day as I brush my teeth or eat my lunch or whatever it may be. And I don't know this company directly, but I admire them enormously. I mean, I just have huge admiration for the way that this company is building this building. And it's, I think, consistent with what some of your writing points to, which is this convergence between intention and action, right? So you see a building in the intention of an architect, presumably, but it has to be owned by the intention of the builder who's actually going to build the building. And this is a building with some pretty unusual architectural features, which they have just been so careful and beautiful at creating, right? And they say, as their slogan, we exist to build significant buildings. And,
oh, that's a cool slogan.
And it's, you can see that that's exactly how this building is being built. And the seriousness of it and the industry, the craftsmanship, the labor of the people that are doing the actual construction. I mean, it's really amazing thing to watch this day in and day out for what will be 2.5 years by the time it's all done. And it's a very, very impressive effort. It puts these two things that you're describing, I think, together.
You know, and almost all the time when you find a company like that, that you admire from the outside and you go and you really begin to study them, you find that the common denominator is they care for their people.
Hmm.
It just amazes me that I can see a company that is doing good work in a fair way, in a way that seems ethical and upright. And then you start talking to the people that work there and they just love the company. It just happens over and over again.
Yeah. Well, it would not surprise me to discover that about this company. One of the ways that it's evident is that they have a meeting every morning at 7, and the guy who's the main supervisor of the project on a bullhorn gives them instructions. But this happens after they've spent about 15 minutes as a team of about 50 or 60 guys, mostly doing exercises together.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Which is only visible because I can look down into where they're actually working.
Yeah.
This would be completely invisible from the street. But where I can see, they stand in a circle, and pertinent to your point about caring for their people and being serious about wanting to avoid injury and, you know, all that, they do these warm-up exercises. And it's like, okay, we're going to spend the day working together. Let's warm up for it. And now I'm going to give you the directions about what you're going to do. And now we're going to do it. And we're going to do
that's great.
Really hard for like 10 or 12 hours or whatever their workday seems to be.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I don't think I'm going to start doing that with my crew. I have a feeling they mutiny on me.
Well, feel free to, you know, take up some new exercise regimes.
Yeah.
If you feel like that might help. Yeah. So one side of your concern is about how you move from profit toward nonprofit concerns and priorities. But the other side that you mentioned is how you move from doing nonprofit leadership to also doing it in a business sensible, appropriate way. Mm-hmm. Tell people a little bit before we get into that. You've been involved in a lot of different nonprofit work, but let's use Pathlight International as one of the primary examples. Tell people about Pathlight, and then I'll ask you a few questions.
Yeah, Pathlight is about a decade old now, maybe 12 years, something like that. And it really started because my wife, Dion, and I have had a long and wonderful relationship in Belize in Central America. And we've had a property down there that is basically a jungle resort. It's a nonprofit jungle resort that's owned by our family foundation, and people come and stay, and the profits are poured back into community development in the area, and specifically to Pathlight. So Pathlight grew out of that. And we found that students in Belize are getting no support for education after what we would call eighth grade, just none at all. They could go to high school, but they had to qualify kind of in the same way that here we have to qualify for college, and they had to pay for the whole thing. And in many of these villages where people earn $5 a day per household, they can't afford the $2 a day in bus fare to get back and forth to high school.
Right.
So we stepped in and started a sponsorship program. That led to the teachers actually asking us to give teacher training. And that has led to a lot of service groups that go down and work in the schools and build classrooms, that kind of thing. The government of Belize has since partnered with us as well. We have a memorandum of understanding with them, which is fantastic. So that's what Pathlight does. And it's all Belizean run in Belize. And our only U.S. citizens that are employed by us are here in the U.S. And they're mostly the marketing, the recruitment, and advertising, that kind of stuff.
Right. So take us on the journey of developing a nonprofit like that and trying to do what you were advising a little bit ago, which is to do nonprofit work, but to do it with strong business.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it was the term mission creep comes to mind immediately when I think about badly run nonprofits. You know, God's work is everywhere. It's so much around us. And we start down a path and say, we are going to do this, whether it's famine relief or evangelism or, you know, an IJM type work. We start down these paths and then we find out that you can go in a million different ways. And the discipline to stay focused on what you do well mm-hmm. is actually sort of business 101.
Right.
And a lot of nonprofits violate that. It'd be so tempting for us, for instance, we're in the school systems. Well, when you get into the school systems, you can start working in healthcare, you can start working in family counseling. The list goes on and on of all the things that we can touch and make a difference in. And it's tempting to start expanding like crazy. The problem with that is you won't do anything very well. And so we've tried to stay very disciplined in what we do. And more nonprofits need to do that, I think. There's also, I think, a tendency that there's this inherent discipline in business because money is the currency. We measure success by the profits. Nonprofits, I think, have a difficult time measuring what success they're really after. Mm-hmm. And I wish more of them put more time into thinking through what's our currency? Mm-hmm. Is our currency more kids graduating from high school? Or is our currency more kids professing faith in Christ? What is our currency mm-hmm. that we see as success?
Right.
And I wish more would do that. That would be super helpful.
So ground that for us at Pathlight. How would you describe the currency of Pathlight then?
Yeah, we see Pathlight's long-term success being defined by, well, we joke that someday a Pathlight graduate will be prime minister of the country.
Yes, right.
I actually think that's viable. It could happen.
Right.
And we believe that success for us is a whole generation of students that grow into young men and women who have a vibrant faith, have the competencies to succeed in life, and are prepared for leadership in their nation.
Hmm. It's marvelous, really marvelous. And yet I can see in that those three themes that you just mentioned, the potential that you're saying you have to fight, which is mission creep, because you could imagine so many things that might attach themselves under any one of those three things. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, there's a really great book called The Engine of Impact. Perhaps you've come across it. It's called The Engine of Impact.
What's it called?
The Engine of Impact,
Essentials
of Strategic Leadership in the Nonprofit Sector. Kim Yonker and Bill Meehan have written it. And it talks extensively, really, about mission creep in a very, very constructive way. So I just am partly dragging that to your attention if you didn't know about it. But certainly for the people that might be listening, it's a great resource.
Yeah, yeah. I have heard of the book. I haven't read it, but I've heard about it.
Yeah.
You've just added it to my reading list.
You know, one of the things that I'm sure you've experienced through your connections both with Westmont and also you're part of the advisory council for the Dupree Center for Leadership here at Fuller. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in those educational contexts, there is a potential of great mission creep in its own way. And part of what I think Fuller certainly is trying to tackle in a moment like this, where we have been an institution that has tended to be very expansive in our sense of abilities about what we think the gospel is and what we think it means in the world and how it is that it needs to be engaged and so forth. So we're constantly finding the mission creep that has been and or the mission creep that might get us today. I guess I'm just curious, if you were to give me some tips on mission creep, what are the other questions? You mentioned currency. That's a critical one. What other ones would you think are important to ask?
I also mentioned just identify what you're good at and stick it to it. Mm-hmm. It's so tempting to be successful at one thing and think you can do anything.
Right.
So that would be a big one. The other part, and this is probably especially true for nonprofits, and I wouldn't necessarily say Fuller is guilty of this, but there is a tendency sometimes, I think, for nonprofits to have the donor wag the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And that's dangerous.
Very dangerous,
You don't want to chase money.
Right.
And I've seen this happen a lot with major donations, but I've also seen it happen with foundations that think they have a better handle on how to solve problems than the nonprofit does. So they will only fund very specific things and the nonprofit bends to that.
Right.
That's a real danger.
It's a great danger. Yeah. Yeah. I've been in conversations with donors who are wanting Fuller to be a particular thing. And as you say, the temptation is always there, but the necessity of trying to be as clear as you can about what we do and what we're not doing is also really critical. Otherwise, you feel like you're almost assigning yourself to permanent bondage.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a bondage that fundamentally distorts the mission that you really definitely have. Tell me, Roy, the book has now been out for how long, this most recent book, Salvaged?
About 3 months now.
Yeah. So what are you finding that people are, what kind of feedback? I'm not asking you to be self-complimentary, though it's totally fine if you are. I'm just curious, what are you hearing back from people about the kind of questions or issues that the book is raising?
Part of the fun I'm having with the book is that people that don't normally consider themselves leaders are loving the book.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And that part's been really fun because that's right. who I wrote the book for.
Yes.
People at really high levels of leadership, they have tremendous resources out there. Mm-hmm. And some of that applies to all the rest of us. You know, I run still a relatively small company, and some of those leadership books are great, but a lot of it, I just kind of frankly roll my eyes at and mm-hmm. go, this doesn't apply to what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write a book that had a message and valuable lessons for somebody that teaches a class, that drives the UPS truck, that mm-hmm. works the night shift at the hospital. Mm-hmm. You know, these people are leaders in their own way.
Absolutely.
And we need to recognize that. And we also need to recognize that some of the leadership lessons we have out there don't apply to what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So it's been really fun for me to get that. The other part is I tell some stories that I think are amusing, and I hope people laugh at some of those stories. I'm getting great feedback that people have been laughing, and that's fun to hear.
You know, I think your comments earlier about being able to embrace your own failure and to find God's grace in the midst of it is directly related to humor, because so often, as we know, it's the failure to be able to laugh at ourselves is one of the things that impinges the most on our ability to either learn or be human or be in community in meaningful ways or whatever it may be. So you're a great exemplar of that.
Well, thank you. I think people are hungry for authenticity and transparency.
Yeah.
So I try. I do my fair of cover up as well, but I try.
Right. You've mentioned you have a wonderful daughter who's a Fuller grad and who's very much a part of the legacy, I think, as I see it, of Fuller's impact on her. But also, she's grown up in this unusual family of yours with this kind of dual vision of both profit and nonprofit work and ministry. So you've stood alongside somebody as she herself has become a nonprofit leader and the starter of a nonprofit.
Right.
And I guess I'm just thinking about people that might be listening to this broadcast who have their own entrepreneurial ideas about what effective mission might mean in this time. So if you're holding together these two themes of strong motivation by the gospel to respond to the most vulnerable and the lessons of both scripture and of business, what would be some of your advice for people that are entrepreneurs and perhaps especially young entrepreneurs working particularly in the nonprofit space?
Yeah, I got to tell you, Mark, that's a tough question to answer because every single situation is so different. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I get asked that fairly often and I always kind of punt. I will try to answer it for you, but I got to tell you, I always get nervous because what we have done as a company, as a family, my wife and I as a partnership, has been a reflection of our own gifts and our own weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And we had these amazing two kids. My daughter, as you mentioned, went to Fuller. She started an organization that combats human trafficking. I mean, this is great stuff. But I know people that don't have anything at all like that in their background or their experience that are doing amazing things.
Right.
So I always get a little bit cautious about taking mm-hmm. my experiences and applying to others. And a great example of that is I was fortunate enough to be born into a family that owned their own business mm-hmm. and was welcomed into that business by my father, my older brother, my siblings, and eventually was asked to run that business. Not everybody's born into a family that has a family business.
Right.
Much less one that owns a lot of land that they bought back in the 40s and 50s that became Silicon Valley. So a lot of this is serendipity or God's design. But to the core of your question, I would say listen a lot. Take the time to really listen in the areas that you know you're not an expert. Mm-hmm. I think so many people make the mistake of thinking, I was very good in business, therefore I can do ministry well.
Right.
Or vice versa. I've seen successful pastors and authors and writers say, oh, well, I can do a business really well. I would say take the time to deeply listen mm-hmm. and humble yourself before people that know a lot more than you do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wish I had done that when I was young, frankly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one of the things that strikes me about you, Roy, over the years has been that you've always remained, from the years that I've known you, always such an active learner. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily want to learn or actually are learners. We easily arrive at a stage, particularly if we've had the privilege of background education, opportunity that's come our way, that we have the privilege of thinking that our experience is normative. And I love the fact that you started this response by saying that that can't be taken for granted and that it might distort what you would offer as advice as much as help it. But that listening posture you're describing is critical.
A young man that I mentor asked me what advice I would give to myself at his age. And I laughed and said, wear more sunscreen. honestly, it's kind of like, look, my advice to who I was when I was 22 isn't necessarily applicable to you at 22.
Yeah. That's great. Well, I just want to say thank you, Roy, for being what I think of as a great exemplar of a lay theologian, a person who doesn't do it for the sake of some sort of academic audience, but is theologizing continuously in your work and in your writing. And I think one of the reasons why I've appreciated your books a lot has been that it does try to bring biblical wisdom, business experience, a heart for Christ and for the vulnerable in the world together in a really applied way. And I think that it's all of that together that makes what you're offering rich and valuable. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for being a
Well, thank you for those kind today. Words. But I got to tell you, when Dionne hears this, she's just going to roll her eyes and go, you don't know the Roy I really know.
And I know Dionne enough to imagine she might.
Yeah. Oh, she will. She's going to roll her eyes and turn off the show.
Exactly. No. I think we've had enough, Roy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.